Hello, it's Debbie back again on a Wednesday. This time it is October 19th, 2016, the Decatur Herald and Review from RE Edition. Starting, of course, on the front page, we have got a wonderful picture of an accessible dock with people fishing and folks here. All ability levels, including somebody in a pretty elaborate wheelchair. And the guy in the wheelchair saying, Mike Summers advises his daughter Cassie Summers as they compete in a fishing contest with Cassie's fellow Millikan women's basketball team members and guests during an event at the Woodlake Handicap Accessible Fishing Dock near Findlay. So the headline says, easier access to lake. Doc makes enjoying fishing a possibility for more individuals. This is by Justin Kahn of the H&R staff. Sullivan, when Jay Williams pulled up to the new fishing dock at Woods Lake, his eyes widened and his jaw dropped. Williams, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Coordinator for Disabled Outdoor Opportunities, was still in shock as he spoke to the crowd gathering on Friday for the Millikan Women's Basketball Team's Mobility Challenge Fishing Event. Quote, we do a lot of things for people with disabilities, outdoor recreation, fishing, hunting, but I'll tell you what, when I drove up here and saw this, I was like, wow, Williams said. I had no clue that something like that had been built. We built accessible areas in Illinois, but nothing like this. This is the kind of thing you can do when you get the right people together, unquote. What used to be invasive trees and weeds is now an accessible location to fish and boat for the mobility challenged. There's a gravel parking lot, split log fence, a boat dock, and large roof fishing dock, all accessible by wheelchair. The lake itself is beautiful and well-stocked. It all began with a phone call from HSHS St. Mary's athletic trainer Bob Hill to Millikan women's basketball coach Lori Gerrans. Hill is the president of Central Illinois Sportsmen for Outdoor Accessibility, which has a mission of improving access to woods and water for those with physical challenges. Bob called me and asked if I knew anyone who might be interested in the fishing project, said Karens of the initial phone call, which she estimated at 5 to 7 years ago. I told him the best fisherman I knew was my dad, Bob Karens. Hill, originally from Mattoon, used to fish in the area in high school. He struck a friendship with Bob Karens, and they approached the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at Lake Shelbyville. The two Bobs approached us, and we immediately saw the value in it because there's such limited access to Lake Shelbyville, Army Corps of Engineers Operation Manager John Summers said. The Army Corps of Engineers deals with several partners and secured $35,000 from the federal government to help pay for the $200,000 project. Volunteer work was key. Ambuxa Sullivan provided labor to build the docks, students from Okaw Valley High School built the fence, and a host of others donated their time, money, and other resources. Woods Lake's new fishing area had a grand opening 2 weeks ago during which it poured down rain, but it got a second chance for an introduction to the public when Lori Karens was looking for something to do with her team on an off day. Bob Karens had the perfect idea. He said, on a good day off, you go fishing, Lori Karens said. I asked, where? And my nephew, Zach Hollis, said, at Woods Lake. That's where you catch all the fish. After the team decided to go fishing, they invited several mobility challenged, disabled, and handicapped individuals to go with them. They split into teams with the players. Team names include the Floppers, the Dennis Rodmen, Hooked on Bluegill, and Anchor Management, and had a fishing contest. Afterwards, they gathered for hot dogs and s'mores. Among those fishing was Mike Summers and his daughter Cassie, a sophomore on the Millikan team. Mike is disabled following an accident a decade ago that left him in a wheelchair. This is really awesome, said Mike, who admitted he's not much of a fisherman. Cassie said she's not either, but placed a worm on the hook and pulled up a fish out of Woods Lake a minute later. people don't necessarily think about people who are mobility challenged every day, especially if they don't know someone, Cassie said. So it's awesome to see a big group who do and to be part of it. But the area isn't just for handicapped and disabled. Bob Cairns, who doesn't get around as well after damaging his knee in a fall, said it's for anyone who could use the help accessing the lake. For people my age, this gets harder and harder, Bob Cairns said. That's why this is a priority of mine. It took a while, but it was worthwhile. End of that article. Another above the fold article, Life for Child Rapist, Man Convicted on Several Counts of Assault and Abuse. This is by Huey Freeman, another staff writer for the Herald and Review. Decatur. She was younger than 13 years old and Michael D. Wilhelm repeatedly sexually assaulted her. 7 years later, she sat in the witness box in a courtroom with Wilhelm sitting directly in front of her at the defense table about 15 feet away. Before she entered the courtroom, she said she felt like a big weight lifted off her when a jury convicted Wilhelm last month because she would not have to worry about him stalking her as he had in the past. As she read aloud her statement, the young woman looked straight down at her notebook paper, unaware that Wilhelm, 40, who would be sentenced to life in prison during this hearing, was staring right at her. When I was younger, I thought the living nightmare would never end, she said, as Associate Macon County Judge Jeffrey Geisler, two attorneys, several relatives and supporters listed with rapt attention. I was scared to stay in my own home, ride in the same vehicle as him, sleep and be alone. She said she wanted to stay away from him and hide. All because of all this, I have developed depression, she said. Wilhelm, who declined to give a statement in his own behalf at his sentencing hearing Tuesday afternoon, was convicted September 1 of 4 counts of predatory criminal sexual assault and 6 counts of aggravated criminal assault. His attorney, assistant public defender Scott Reuter, said Wilhelm disagreed with the jury's findings. Reuter filed a motion for a new trial on the grounds that the court mistakenly allowed testimony of previous crimes. Geisler denied the motion. Because he was convicted of predatory sexual criminal assault of two different children, Wilhelm's sentence was automatically life in prison without parole, according to statute. Geisler sentenced him to an additional 6 years in prison for his convictions on the 6 counts of the lesser charge. He was sentenced to 6 years on each count to be served concurrently with each other but consecutive to the life sentence. He was also ordered to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life and have no contact with the victims. After pronouncing his sentence, Geisler said he was present during the trial and could only imagine the nightmares the children endured. I think a sentence of natural life is appropriate in this case, Geisler said. Because the judge was not in the position to decide the length of the sentence in any meaningful way, the one young woman who was the only one who volunteered to speak. Normally, the state would present statements from multiple victims and witnesses in order to try to influence the judge as to the length of the sentence. The other two victims of whom Wilhelm was convicted of raping or abusing were present in the gallery along with the staff of the Child First Center. A fourth victim, who Wilhelm raped when she was 7 years old in 1991, was also present. She testified at the trial, but the case had already been settled, with Wilhelm receiving a 1-year probation term in juvenile court. Wanda Helm, Wilhelm's sister, testified that Michael was a good brother, a pretty good kid who was very good in his own children. In response to a question by Reuter as to whether he was ever violent or mean, she said, "No, not really." The young woman who was raped by Wilhelm in 1999 during the time period he was employed as a bus driver for Decatur School District 61 said he ruined her childhood as well as the childhoods of other victims. I never had that childhood life that everyone talks about. They expressed how amazing it was, how they'd wish to go back. My childhood was a living nightmare. Because of this man, I was afraid to speak to my own mother. He threatened to kill my whole family if I opened my mouth about it. She said she wanted to thank Amanda Havener, the victim's advocate, Eric Ethel, Decatur police detective, and Kate Kurtz, assistant state attorney. The young woman, who paused frequently during her testimony, successfully fighting off tears, said she had nightmares as she was growing up, and then they ended. She referred to the fact that the case was first prosecuted in 2010, then dismissed before Wilhelm ever went to trial. It was then reopened and charged as a new case in 2015 as new evidence came to light. Then the nightmares returned. returned to the young woman who was first interviewed as a child. Everything came back. I thought it was over, that I'd never see his face again, she said. I had to get re-interviewed, tell people what had happened to me on different occasions. I tried to forget, but it's something no one can forget. But I tried. I didn't succeed. After the case resurfaced, she decided that she wanted to make something of herself to show that this thing, which affected her life in the most horrifying way, would not stop her from doing what she wanted to do. She enrolled in a challenging school, graduating in June, but then she heard she had to testify at the trial and see Willem's face again. She broke down. I felt as if I had just failed, she said. But an instructor at her school reassured her that she was strong, that she could get enough, she could get through this and show them she was doing something with her life. But most of all, she wanted to show the devil himself that he doesn't control me anymore. I did it, she said in a calm, steadying voice. I faced the devil himself, and he's gotten what he deserves. End of that article. Continuing with the front page, one of two articles at the under the fold, politicians continue bid to save Clinton plant. This is by Dan Petrella, the Springfield Bureau, the Lee Springfield Bureau Chief. That's hard to say. Lee Springfield Bureau Chief. Springfield. A state senator from Chicago plans to use the General Assembly's upcoming fall veto session to continue pushing legislation that Exelon Core says is essential to the future of its financially struggling Clinton and Quad Cities nuclear power plants. Senator Dunn Trotter, D-O-N-N-E, Dunn Trotter, a Democrat from the southeast side, made the statement Tuesday in Chicago during a forum on Illinois' nuclear energy industry hosted by the University of Illinois Nuclear Engineering Department and the Illinois AFL-CIO. The event, titled Nuclear Power, What It Means in Illinois, included officials from the U.S. Department of Energy, representatives from organized labor, federal and state lawmakers, local officials, and other experts. After Illinois lawmakers ended their regular spring legislative session without approving Exelon's proposed next-generation energy plan, the Chicago-based company announced that it would move forward with plans to shutter the Clinton Power Plant next year and the Quad Cities Generating Station in June 2008. Petrotter and other sponsors of the legislation, including Republican State Senators Chapin Rose and Muhammad and Neil Anderson of Rock Island, say negotiations with Exelon, environmental and consumer groups, the renewable energy industry, and downstate utility Ameren, Illinois, have continued in the intervening months. It's coming together, and hopefully by the time we get back November 15th, there'll be enough consensus that we can move forward with it and get it through the Senate as well as the House, Trotter said, noting that some House members were in attendance and that House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat Chicago, made a brief appearance. Madigan spokesman Steve Brown said the speaker's waiting to review the final version of the legislation before taking a position. Exelon, which has lost a combined $800 million on the two plants over the past 7 years, says the state's current energy policy doesn't properly value the, quote, economic, environmental, and reliability benefits, unquote, of nuclear power. It's seeking subsidies for its nuclear operations similar to those given to the wind and solar energy industries. Experts who spoke at Tuesday's forum said nuclear power, which doesn't produce greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change, will be a key component in helping the United States achieve its goal of reducing carbon emissions by 32% from 2005 levels by 2030. Sustaining the current fleet of nuclear power plants and building new nuclear capacity can build an important role in meeting this goal and also critical if the U.S. is to maintain its global leadership as the world looks to nuclear power to meet its clean energy needs, said John Kotek, acting secretary for the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy. Nuclear power, which accounts for about 60% of the carbon-free energy generated nationwide, quote, is responsible for avoiding hundreds of millions of tons of carbon dioxide emissions that would be released each year if we had to rely on fossil fuel generation for that electricity, Kotek said, noting that the Energy Department doesn't take a position on specific state-level proposals. Union officials, including Lonnie Stephenson, international president of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, spoke of the important role the Clinton and Quad Cities plants play in their communities by providing high-paying jobs for highly skilled workers, a message that was echoed by Clinton City Administrator Tim Folwell and Henry Marquard, director of the government affairs for the Quad Cities Chamber of Commerce. The plants are also primary sources of property tax revenue for their communities, officials said. Marquard added that if energy prices rise as a result of the Quad Cities plant shutting down, quote, there's no doubt it out, unquote, that manufacturers will leave the area. Rose, whose Senate district includes the Clinton plant, told attendees, "We are here today because the state of Illinois is facing a generational choice. That choice is between a clean, reliable source of power and an uncertain future of possible energy price hikes," he said. Opponents of the legislation have argued that some of its provisions could cause unpredictable fluctuations in consumers' energy bills, harm burgeoning renewable energy businesses. Some critics say it's a bailout for a profitable corporation. That's the end of Dan Petrella's article. Now for kind of a back to the future kind of thing. Not in Kansas anymore. Campaign hopes to rescue Ruby Oz slippers, Washington, out of Washington by AP. It will take more than three clicks of the heels to preserve the ruby slippers that whisked Dorothy back to Kansas at the end of Wizard of Oz. The slippers, which for more than 30 years have been one of the most beloved items at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, were crafted almost 80 years ago by MGM Studios' prop department. Like most movie props, they weren't built to last. Now, the frayed shoes aren't even ruby-colored anymore. They're more like a dull auburn. On Monday, the Smithsonian asked the public to help save the slippers, launching a Kickstarter campaign to raise $300,000. In addition to keeping the shoes' colors from deteriorating further, the money will go toward a technologically advanced display case that will preserve them for future generations. The Smithsonian museums are federally funded, but the institution frequently solicits private and corporate contributions for major projects that its budget doesn't cover. This is the Smithsonian's second Kickstarter campaign. In 2015, the National Air and Space Museum raised $700,000 through crowdfunding site to preserve the spacesuit that Neil Armstrong wore when he was on the moon. This particular pair of ruby slippers really belongs to the American people, so we thought we would, as we sought support, that we would invite the public to join us on this journey to help preserve them for the next generation, said Melinda Mercado, a museum spokeswoman. If the Kickstarter campaign is successful, the slippers will be the second most researched item in the museum's collection behind the flag that inspired Francis Scott Key to write the Star Spangled Banner, said Richard Barden, the museum's head of conservation. The shoes are the most recognizable prop for the beloved 1939 musical. Their deep red hue dazzling audiences when the movie made its dramatic transition from black and white to Technicolor. They have been on near constant display since they were anonymously donated to the museum in 1979. Their age is showing, and preserving them is more complicated than it might appear. The slippers contain a dozen different materials. The sequins are made of gelatin with a primitive plastic coating, and many are no longer red because the coating is flaked off, in part because of decades of exposure to light and moisture. The undersides of the sequins, or the portions that did not have direct exposure to light, have retained more of their color. The shoes also include glass beads and red felt on the soles that was used to muffle their sound when Judy Garland wore them during dance sequences. The pair has also mismatched. One shoe is wider than the other, and there are other subtle differences in their shape. Each has Garland's name written inside. The museum will research the ideal conditions for the various materials that make up the shoes. The new case is likely to contain a gas other than oxygen, which controls on temperature, humidity, and barometric pressure, said Richard Barden, the museum's head of conservation. That case becomes very expensive to build, and we want to build one that will be efficient and low maintenance, so we're doing the best for the slipper and keeping our costs as low as possible, Barton said. As of Tuesday afternoon, donors had pledged more than $70,000 on Kickstarter. If the museum does not reach its $300,000 goal in 30 days, no one will be charged. Donations start at $1, and depending on how much they give, contributors can receive rewards, including T-shirts, tote bags, created by William Ivy Long, a Tony Award-winning costume designer. End of that article, end of the first page. Okay, local, page A3, more mental health court success. Program has helped 24 graduates since 2011 launch. This is by Teresa Churchill, a senior writer for H&R. Decatur, Misty Thomas St. Arnold believed she'd been beaten by two men on bicycles last summer, right up until the police showed her video of herself walking unmolested along West Pershing Road on the date and time of the alleged attack. When the police officer came and told me I'd filed a false police report, I was still swearing up and down. It was real, St. Arnold recalled. Come to find out, the Decatur woman had suffered a psychotic break, and one of the first things that happened after her case was transferred to Macon County's mental health court in February 2015 was to get her back on the antipsychotic that had treated her bipolar disorder best. It was a drug she'd been forced to stop taking some months earlier because Medicaid would no longer cover it. As a result, St. Arnold was able to continue working as a certified nursing assistant despite being charged with a felony and because she successfully completed mental health court. The charge was dismissed and removed from her record August 2nd. The Decatur woman and her husband are moving north later this month to begin training CNAs at Heartland Health Center's facility in Wyoming, Michigan. St. Arnold, 48, was one of five people who completed mental health court in recent months, bringing the total number of graduates to 24 since the program began in 2011. The court operates with more than $80,000 of its $100,000 annual budget provided by the Macon County Mental Health Board and carries a caseload of about 25 at any given time. Circuit Judge R.C. Bollinger admitted two new participants Tuesday. Other graduates who participated in ceremony after court was over included Yang Jinhe, 35, and Lee Lyons, 23. Amy Gillen, a specialty court liaison, said in an interview that mental health court is successful because the people who are further along in the program become a support system for those coming in. Indeed, when it was his turn to receive a plank, Dima was praised by Bollinger for mentoring another defendant. St. Arnold told court staff and her peers she would not be where she is if it weren't for them, her husband and her mother. I had struggles throughout this program, she said, but we are a family, and families support each other in good times and in bad. And next one, headlined, Race for Education, Event Brings in Needed Cash at Decatur Christian. This is by Valerie Wells of the staff for H&R. Forsyth, Ken and Linda McCollum send their own children to parochial school, and when grandson Micah Thompson came along, they encouraged his parents to send him to Decatur Christian. We believe in Christian schools, Linda McCollum said. We have nothing against public schools, but in Christian schools, they learn Christian values. On Tuesday, Decatur Christian held its annual Race for Education, and the McCollums were there to volunteer, as they often are. Parochial schools don't receive state funding, so fundraising is important. Tuition alone can't cover all the costs of running a school and paying the staff. The Race for Education is one of two annual fundraisers, said Administrator Randy Grigg. Students ask friends and family to pledge either a flat amount or a per lap amount, and the children run or walk around a course behind the school building in Forsyth. Especially the elementary, they send out notes and try to get people to support them for however many laps they do, Grigg said. This is really one of our biggest fundraisers for the year, and the kids just try to solicit support. High school students stood next to the course and handed out tickets as the younger students passed them as a way to keep track of the number of laps each student ran. Junior Grace Miller said she'd attended Decatur Christian since kindergarten, and while the high school students don't do the race, volunteering for it is their way of contributing. The McKinneys have 13 children, 10 of them adopted, and 10 of the 13 attend Decatur Christian. Two are in preschool, three in fifth, one in eighth, and three are high school juniors, and one is a senior. My tuition payment is more than my house payment, and it's worth every penny, said Mom Ann McKinney, who was also volunteering at the event where her two preschool boys, twins from China, were wildly popular with the older students. The little boys wore T-shirts with the Chinese for brother and the translation in English under it. In addition to the Race for Education, Decatur Christian holds a spring dinner event, and in November, investment planners and IPI Wealth Management will present the Jersey Tenors at the Lincoln Theater with Broadway star Brian Noonan, which will also benefit the school. Greg said most of that event's proceeds will be dedicated to the scholarship fund. The money raised by the Race for Education goes into a general fund. End of that article. Continuing, Melton named head of RCC Foundation by Ryan Voiles, Decatur. With more than a decade of experience in nonprofits and fundraising, Julie Melton is ready to bring her skills to the Richland Community College. Melton was unanimously appointed as the new executive director of the college's foundation during Tuesday evening's meeting of the college's Board of Trustees. She will begin her new role Monday. Aside from her current role as the Director of Gift Administration for the University of Illinois Foundation, Melton has previously worked with the American Cancer Society, Eastern Illinois Food Bank, and the President's Covenant Foundation. After her approval, Melton said she was excited to bring all the skills she's learned over the years to Richland and bring in more donors and dollars to the institution. I love how close-knit Richland is. Everything is under one roof, and you can really see the impact of the donations right in front of you every day, she said. The foundation is not-for-profit corporation seeking the private funds that provide distinction in educational programs and facilities at Richland Community College. Melton will replace Richard McGowan, who retired this summer. One of the projects that private funds have helped to bring closer to fruition is the Carroll Center for Business, as board members were given a better idea on the progress of the estimated $3.5 million facility. Greg Florian, Richland Vice President of Finance and Administration, told the board that programming and concept design were finished earlier this month, with schematic designs to be finished by the end of the month. Construction is expected to take 1 year. Florian said they still aim to hit the $3.5 million cost estimate for the project. Funding is currently at $3.3 million, though the foundation is waiting word of a gift from several donors. End of that article. And then as we finish part one, we'll start on the briefs. Decatur, breakfast buffet. This is for tomorrow. The Milliken chapter of Delta Delta will hold Delta House of Pancakes, Breakfast of Champions from 5 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, October 20th. Tickets to the All-You-Can-Eat Breakfast Buffet are $5 before the event and $7 at the door. Proceeds benefit St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Again, Decatur, year-old theft. A metal detector valued at $900 was stolen in Decatur from a firm that does underground surveying to locate utility services. Written police reports say the detector is owned by the USIC company and was stolen a year ago in October, but the theft wasn't reported till Monday. Next, Arts Council trip. Bus trips to the Fabulous Fox Theater in St. Louis will begin Sunday, November 6th to a matinee of the a cappella show Straight No Chaser. Tickets are $165, include transportation, lunch at the Fox, premium seating, and a snack on the ride home. To reserve a seat, call the Decatur Area Arts Council, 423-3189. 423-3189. Theater road trip season includes An American in Paris, Cabaret, and Lion King in the 2016-17 lineup. Next, Urban Farm School. An Urban Farm School class will be offered through the Continuing and Professional Education Division at the Richland Community College. The class is intended to prepare each participant for the next planting season. It'll be held on Tuesdays. Information at Richland. And that concludes part one of the Decatur Herald and Review for October 19th, a Wednesday in 2019, read by Debbie, and I will be back shortly.